Today's Teisho is on case 23 in the Book of Serenity, Luzu Faces the Wall. Introduction. Bodhidharma's 9 years is called wall gazing. Shengguan's 3 bows divulge the natural potential. How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. Nan Chuan, hearing of this, said, "I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty eon, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Lu Zhu, that way, will go on till the year of the ass." Verse. In plainness, there's flavor, subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. Unbending, like an idiot, his path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and winters afar. In some ways, Zen is probably the strangest form of Buddhism. Of all the different forms of Buddhism, Zen is probably the strangest, the weirdest, the most baffling, the most crazy, etc., etc. And probably in the history of religion, Zen is also quite unique in being unlike anything else that I can think of. You know, we recite sutras every morning, and these are the sutras that were passed down to me by my teacher, Kangan Webb Roshi. And everybody gets up and sits down on the cushion, and we recite the sutras. And the sutras are Japanese transliterations of Chinese transliterations of Sanskrit. Now, a transliteration means that we're not trying to convey the meaning. We're trying to convey the sound. So, you know, it would be relatively simple to translate the sutras. And we could get up every morning and sit down, and we could recite a good English language verse. And we could inspect it, and we could think about it, or we could evaluate it and commit it to memory, whatever we'd like to do with it. And in fact, some of what we recite is in English. For example, the Xin Jin Ming is in English, and when we recite that, it has a recognizable content. But much of what we recite in the morning has no intellectual content at all. And it's sometimes justified or explained as a breathing exercise. So people will come and ask me, what are we doing when we're reciting the sutras? And I'll say, sometimes if I don't feel like giving a long, drawn-out explanation, I'll just say, breathing exercise. And that seems to make them happy, you know. So, okay, it's a breathe, that makes sense. Okay. But actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. You know, we're reciting words that have no intellectual meaning, and we are working with the breath, that's true. That is a dimension of it. But it's a strange practice, right? I mean, if you go to, say, Sunday school, you know, as a kid, you recite Bible verses and you have a Sunday school teacher who will tell you stories about Jesus and the apostles, and you're supposed to remember those stories, and they make sense, you know. And if you're in a synagogue, you're at a Saturday school, and you're studying Jewish tradition, same thing. If you're in the Muslim world and you study the Quran, you know, you want to get the verses right, you learn how to recite them, and the meaning is tremendously important, you know. So Zen is a little offbeat. Zen is a little bit weird, because it would be like, you know, you open your holy book, and it doesn't make any sense to anybody, you know. In fact, you know, in some Zen temples, they actually have a day where they are supposed to begin studying all the Buddhist sutras. So, you know, in Christianity, basically, there's one book of the Bible, and that includes the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in Islamic tradition, there's the Quran, and then there are some other books, Hadith, and some other books which are like acts or sayings of the Prophet, and so on. In Indian tradition, there's more holy books. You've got the Vedas, you've got the Upanishad, you have the Gita. So there's more. But in Buddhism, there's quite a few. There's a very large number of books, of sutras, going back to the Pali Sutras. And in the Zen tradition, there's a day where everybody is supposed to begin the study of all the sutras. And the Mahayana Sutras, the early Buddhist Mahayana Sutras, are actually called the Agamas. So there's the Pali Sutras, and then there's the Sanskrit Agamas, and the Agamas are the Mahayana version of the Pali Sutras. And in many Zen temples, there's the day where you're supposed to start studying the sutras, and what the monks do is they bring all the books into a room, and they have a ceremony. They recite a sutra, and there's usually a big drum, and while they're beating the drum, a monk picks up each book and thumbs through the pages. And they do each book like that, and then they take it back to the library until next year. So what is that all about? Very strange, you know. You know, if you want a dictionary definition of Zen, it's called the transmission outside the sutras, outside the scriptures, direct pointing to the mind. So, Zen is really quite different from some other forms of Buddhism, and rather different from conventional religion, because we really don't put much store by, formalized knowledge in a written form. What we really study in Zen is the mind itself. And so, we put a great deal of store by meditation practice. And so we sit many hours a day. And we're really, you could say, exploring the mind. That's really what our practice is all about, exploring the mind itself, direct pointing to the mind, the tradition outside the sutras, outside the scriptures. Now, please don't think that I'm criticizing other religions. I think there's a great value to having things written down, to having verses that you can recite. And there's great wisdom in the Bible, in the Quran, in the Upanishads, and so on. I really mean that. I have enjoyed reading I've read all of those books, and I have enjoyed them a great deal. But this is a little different, a little stranger, because we are involved in something that's quite quite different. We're really exploring the mind itself, and our meditation practice is centered on that. So when we recite the sutras, we're actually doing something that's stranger than, say, reciting psalms or something like that. We're activating a deep part of the mind, you could say the unconscious mind. Zen is really very interested in the unconscious mind and the power of the unconscious mind. You know, the Zen view is that a consciousness is essential but somewhat limited. That, you know, basically consciousness alone can't really liberate people. So there are so many examples of this, you know, where people can be, I myself work in an English department, you know, and English departments, when they justify themselves, when they try to explain to the public what they do, say, look, you know, we study literature, and literature is really essential to making people kind, compassionate, intelligent, socially critical, sensitive, and so on and so on. And in an English department, what we do is we have a bunch of books that we study called the canon. And we start with Chaucer, and it goes through Shakespeare, and it goes right up to the contemporary world. And when we try to defend what we do, sometimes to a skeptical public, we say, look, reading books makes you a better person. It makes you kind, it makes you compassionate, and so on and so on. And, you know, there's a truth to this. There's a real truth to this. But then, you know, I live and work in an English department, and so I have a special perspective. You know, if reading literature made people compassionate, kind, patient, and good, when you walk into an English department, it should be like heaven on earth, right? You know, you go to the secretary and she says, hello, how are you? You know, how can I help you? You know, can I speak with the chairman? Come in, my good man, you know, have a seat, you know. All the time in the world for you, you know. You go to the professor and you say, professor, I got a C on my paper, I don't think that's fair. And the professor would, you know, sit down with you and reflect and, you seem like a good lad, you know. I know you've made a good effort. All right, A it is, right? You know? If you go to a real-life English department, you know, you're going to find the usual assortment of human beings, you know. Some of them are going to be very kind. Some of them are actually quite, you know, I mean, I hope you take this the right way, but English departments are, like all other places, are filled with people who have a really egomaniacs, you know. They have no time for their students. There are such people, you know. They're really busy with their own projects. They might not even like students very much, you know. We have occasionally had to deal with professors who just stop meeting their classes, you know. They're too busy to teach. It's a little bit weird, you know. So this idea that that reading books makes us good or kind is contradicted every day, you know. I was reading just recently about a judge in upstate northern New Jersey, who was, you know, basically had been embezzling. And, you know, you think, now, wait a minute, you know, he's a judge. He studied law, right? He ought to be the most, you know, law-observing person in the world, but studying law doesn't make you a good man. You know, I think you see where I'm going with this, that ideas are very important. It's good to have the right ideas, but, you know, really, we're often confused, not by our ideas, but on a deeper level. On a deeper level, we have knots or confusions that aren't really accessible sometimes to the ordinary conscious mind, you know? And so Zen's idea is that we need to get under the surface of consciousness in order to liberate ourselves and become fully compassionate, creative, flexible, and alive. And that this requires a kind of probing or a kind of investigation on a deeper unconscious level. It's good if you read books, you know, on Zen, that's great. But Zen practice is really about probing the unconscious level of going through the mind and encountering our obstacles on this deeper level. And this is not always easy to do. The other day, a person in my department, since I'm talking about the English department, a person in my department, a woman I know, came to see me. And she was, she's a professor in the English department. And she has been having a hell of a time with her teenage son, who's just like 13 or 14. And he is absolutely, it's like, she said, when he was about 9, he was the most wonderful kid, and now it's like having a demon in her house, you know. They fight all the time. You know, he doesn't want to go to school. He doesn't want to do his homework. You know, and he and she get into these long, extended periods of unhappy conflict. So she came to see me, and she said, you know, I know you teach Zen. You know, I'd like some pointers on how to deal with my son. You know, and I had to tell her the truth. You know, I said, you know, in some ways I'm still a teenager myself. I said, first of all, so you need to know that. I said, also, I don't have any kids, so I have no idea, you know, what to do. And I also said that, so please don't take anything I'm going to say seriously. She didn't leave when I said that, and I think she thought I was being modest. But when I listened to her story, my impression was that the son was having a hard time growing up, having a hard time facing up to his responsibilities, and he was. He had found a way to avoid that because, you know, when he would, when he was frustrated, he was really blaming his mom. You know, he would, in very subtle ways, it would always he would always turn it into mom's problem or push it off on mom. So, you know, basically, if he was unhappy, you know, he would go in to see mom, and he knew how to push her buttons. You know what I mean? So. You know, if he was unhappy, something at school wasn't going right, maybe he wasn't getting attention from his friends or wasn't, you know, feeling respected by his friends, he'd be unhappy, he'd get down in the dumps, and then he would come in and he knew how to set his mother off, and he would just push her buttons and she'd go through the ceiling, you know. And then, you know, he would feel better. You know, when she would describe, I know this. In fact, you know, in psychological circles, this is called dumping. It's where you take your unhappiness and you dump it off on somebody else, right? And actually, it does make you feel better. Bosses do this to their workers all the time. So, like, if a boss is feeling under pressure, there's a deadline, and feeling very unhappy, the boss will chew out an underling and then walk away with a big smile on his face. It's like, now you have it, right? You know. So, what I said the mother, I think, really wanted, has a lot of problems with feeling guilty all the time. And so, you know, the son is making her feel guilty, and she is very eager to absorb his guilt, you know, his very eager to accept responsibility. Because she has a lot of problems feeling good about herself. So, you know, the son is giving her, is guilt-tripping her, and she's accepting the guilt, you know. And all of this, I think, happens on an unconscious level. You know, all of this happens on an unconscious level. I don't think the son thinks, I'm unhappy, you know. I will make my mother unhappy and then I'll feel better. You know, he probably hasn't read the article about dumping in Psychology Today, you know, but he's doing it. And he didn't decide to do it. He does it unconsciously, right? It makes him feel better. People work out a routine that makes them feel better, and they don't necessarily do it consciously, in a calculated way. And of course, the mother, I know this woman very well, has a long history of feeling very guilty. Guilt is where she lives her life. And so they're like a perfect couple, right? I mean, the son makes her feel guilty, she absorbs the guilt, he feels less... You know, I said to him, she said, well, do you have any advice? And I just said, look, I think you should tell your son, if you want Buddhist advice, so-called Buddhist advice, you should tell your son that he is entirely responsible for his own unhappiness. And my colleague, was sort of... ambivalent about saying that to her son. And I said, well, if you want the Buddhist answer, that would be it. You know, he has to start taking responsibility for his own unhappiness. He has to admit that this is his doing, right? That basically, you know, he's living in a middle-class New Jersey town. He has no economic privation. All his only job is to go to school. Basically millions, in fact, hundreds of millions of people would be quite happy in his circumstances. So, you know, he's unhappy because of his own life choices and life habits, you know. And you need to put that back on him every time, every hour of the day. You know, when he's miserable, you need to say, you are responsible for your own unhappiness, you know. And I don't know if my friend, my colleague in the English department, will take my advice or not. But it was so clear to me that, she's unable to deal with her son very well because she has this huge reservoir of guilt. She's made guilt her home, so to speak. And probably nothing I could say, to either of them is going to solve the problem in the long run, you know. We all have these unacknowledged problems, unacknowledged obstacles. It's not necessarily possible to change them simply by reading a new book or attending a lecture, something like going to a lecture on raising your child better, how to deal with that teenager, and so on, probably isn't really going to help this person. And maybe he needs to go to a seminar on coping with high school, you know. But most of their problems, I think, are under the surface, you know. I hope I'm making some sense. So Buddhism starts with a little different assumption. It says, you know, even if you had good information, in the form of ideas, it won't necessarily solve your problem because your obstacles are under the surface, you know? And so one way to think about what we're doing when we're doing meditation is that we're going through a series of stages or steps towards a kind of mental hygiene, So first of all, we have to learn how to stabilize the mind. And most people are very, very highly distracted. They really don't have mental stability at all. Their ideas and emotions sweep them along. So, you know, a classic example of this would be somebody who eats because he's anxious, you know. So maybe I have had a hard time at work, and I'm sitting at home, and you know, I'm watching the TV. You know, I'm trying to lose myself in the TV so I don't have to think about the incidents at work. And then, you know, when I watch TV, I almost forget what's going on at work, but I also feel a little bit lonely. So then I go to the refrigerator and I eat something, and it makes me feel gratified for a minute, you know, like I'm feeding the part of me that's hungry. And then I go watch TV, and then I feel lonely, and I go eat, and so on and so on. You know, this is very common sort of way of living your life. You have emotions and thoughts that sweep you along like a leaf flowing down a river, and it's very difficult to get any control over our situation. You know, because we're just there's no place to stand, or there's no place to ground ourselves. We're just swept along like a leaf on a roaring stream. And we're mostly in a reaction mode, and we're responding unconsciously, trying to make ourselves feel better. So, one way to think about the early stages of Zen practice is we're learning how to stabilize the mind. So, you know, we watch the breath, and we watch the breath, and we watch the breath, and little by little, we begin to become calm and focused, so that you're able to hold your attention on the breath for a fairly long period of time. And instead of being caught up in your thoughts, instead of being relentlessly caught up in your thoughts and swept along, you're able to sort of, you could say, stop in the middle of the current and stay still. And this is hugely valuable, this ability to achieve one-pointed concentration is a major breakthrough in Zen practice. And this is like the beginning of liberation, because now, instead of being pushed around by your thoughts, you can hold your attention in the moment, and the thoughts are racing by you, but they're not carrying you along. And this is a preliminary stage of Zen practice, and it usually comes from watching the breath. When we do breath meditation, breath perception meditation, we're learning how to hold the attention still in this roaring torrent of ideas. And as you hold your attention still, you begin to be less gripped by your thoughts. And little by little, you begin to drop down, you could say, through the layers of the mind. So, you know, the top of your mind is like these discriminating thoughts, like I have to get some dog food on the way home. And then under that are pieces of thoughts. You know, just you know, when you're watching your breath, you have these intervals where you're very focused on your breath, but then there are these intervals where there's just little pieces of thoughts coming up. And then there's memory, you know, and imagination. These are all sort of, you could think of as like elements or layers of the mind. As I mentioned yesterday, in Zen, we believe that the core of the mind, the core of consciousness, the root consciousness, is this radiant, compassionate, enlightened mind. And it's already there. We just have to find out how to get to it. So Zen practice is, first of all, freeing ourselves from the torrent of ideas, and learning how to descend down through the layers of the mind, and as we're doing this, we start to work through some of our obstacles, some of our inner obstacles, those obstacles become you might become aware of those obstacles more or less as you're sitting on the cushion. Some people here's a classic example. Somebody will come in and say, I'll say, how's it going with your breath? And they'll say, I have so many distractions. And I'll say, how do you feel? And they say, I'm really mad. You know, I don't know why, but I'm mad. You know, that's a possible answer. And this is like what we call karma, right? This, obviously, this way of responding to frustration is deeply ingrained in a person's personality, you know. So, you know, you're watching your breath, and your mind is wandering back to this, or it's wandering over to that, and you might find yourself getting angry or impatient, sometimes people, they lose that when they get into that state, they start drifting into dreams again, you know. So somebody will come in and say, I'll say, how's it going with your meditation practice? And they'll say, oh, you know, I just can't stop thinking of this girl I know at work. You know, my mind just goes back to her again and again and again. And, what we're seeing here is somebody who has, when they are in a lonely place or they're in a frightening situation or a frustrating situation, they've made a long habit out of spacing out and dissociating and entering like this dream-like, trance-like state. You know, so basically Zen practice is sort of like peeling back all these mental habits and all these layers of the mind. And, part of the give and take of Zen practice with the teacher is, you know, hopefully the teacher can recognize some of these mental habits and try to give you some advice, let you go back to the cushion. You know, but what might happen one day is, a change. You know, a long time ago, there was a person who was practicing, and this person had a lot of anger. Like a lot, you know, a person would come in at the Dokusan and have like a lot of anger. And, just like anger, day one, anger. Day two, anger. Day three, anger, you know. And the person hadn't been aware of it at all. You know, if you met this person, you would think this was the sweetest person, the sweetest guy. You know, he just seemed so nice. And he sat down on the cushion, and basically he had this seething rage underneath, you know. It took a lot of sesshins, but eventually, he realized that he had been very frightened of his father, and his father had been physically abusive of him, you know. And one sesshin in particular, he came in towards the end of the sesshin, and he was crying, you know, and he said, I said, what are you crying about? And he said, you know, I've been so mean to my dog. And he said, I'm going to go home, I'm going to be so nice to that dog, you know. And I felt like crying myself, you know, because this person had worked through so much on the cushion, you know. I mean, probably he was mean to his dog, you know, because people hadn't always been so kind to him, I guess. But he had had some kind of a real insight, real breakthrough into his own behavior, his own responses. And when people encounter an obstacle and they can't get through it, you get a range of emotions like anger or self-hatred, I wish I were dead, you know, this kind of thing. Eventually, though, when people get through their barriers, there's just like this outpouring of love, you know, this outpouring of love. And so, this person had gone through kind of like a classic sesshin, you know, where he had encountered a barrier, you know, he had worked through all this anger, and then at the end of the sesshin, lo and behold, you know, there was a breakthrough and an outpouring of love. You know, when I go home, I'm going to be so kind to my dog, you know. And this is really sort of like, that was like as a Zen teacher, I felt like that was a job well done. You know, I thought, well, you know, that worked out well, you know. So Zen is really all about working on this unconscious level. And people can be frozen for a long time, you know, actually. People can get frozen for a long time. I was frozen myself in my earlier Zen practice. When I was starting out, I really didn't want to look at myself at all, look in my mind at all. I really wanted to be I wanted to be an enlightened person. You know, I wanted to imagine myself as an enlightened person. So when I would go in to see my teacher, I would always try to present a very enlightened and wise a veneer, you know. And so I would say things like, when I would go to see Genki, he was asking me to work on the breath perception koan. And I would go in and I would say things like, all is one. It's ridiculous, right? But I thought he would go, yes, you know, you're so right. It's all one, you know. I guess there were things in myself I just didn't want to open up, you know. Basically, I was a rather isolated person. And I was working on the breath perception, and I was getting nowhere because I guess I was just so afraid of opening up a can of worms inside myself. I was going on for years working with the breath perception koan and getting nowhere, you know, getting nowhere. I was asked to become Tenzo, which is the cook. Here we have a number of people who have been cooking for a long time, and I myself like to cook. But in our group in Seattle, people would be given the job of cooking for 6 months. So, you know, basically you would be asked to come to Sesshin. We did 4 Sesshin a year, and your job would be to come to 2 Sesshin, and your responsibility would be to cook for the group. And so you would have to plan the meals, you would have to do all this preparation, buy the food, and then pretty much your job was to prepare the food, and sitting was secondary. See, you would be in there cooking while everybody else was sitting. You'd be chopping vegetables and everybody else would be sitting. And it was a kind of sacrifice for the good of the community, right? Well, you know, I was working on the breath perception koan. I was watching my breath and I was getting nowhere. And I was going into the teacher and I was saying, all is one, you know. Everybody else was passing their koans, and I was stuck in this rudiment, but I thought this very infantile koan, you know. Then Genki Roshi asked me to be the cook. He said, I want you to be the teisho for the next 6 months. And I said, oh, thank you, Roshi. But what I really meant was, damn it, you know. Because now, instead of being on the cushion and making progress in my Zen training, I will be losing precious time, wasting it on cooking. I mean, that's what I thought. Now, you know, I'm not so unusual in having thoughts like this. I didn't allow myself to see those thoughts at the time. I decided to be the cook. And the strangest thing happened. Because I have worked in a lot of restaurants, with great reluctance, I decided I was going to be the tenzo and do a good job. And then I got into it. I don't know how to put it, but I really began to enjoy preparing for the sesshin. And I kind of forgot about the fact that I wouldn't be making any progress in my training. And I wasn't trying to get any brownie points either. I really wasn't. I was just kind of getting into it, you know. And I bought all the food, I prepared, and I actually did an incredibly good job. You know, I would get up, sit, you know, very, very like a sit or two, and then I would be in the kitchen getting breakfast ready. And I would get the breakfast ready, and then I would be on to lunch, you know, and then I'd be working on that. And I had very few chances to sit. I would come in and hear the teisho. And I made incredibly good food. It was like, I wasn't trying to score points, you know, I was just really, it was like the Zen of cooking. And I even made a béarnaise sauce, if you know what that is. You know, I have training, you know. So we had like tofu and béarnaise sauce or something. But it was great, I'm not kidding, it was great, you know. And I baked bread, you know, all the people, at the end of the evening, people would be going back to their bunkhouse and there would be little loaves of hot bread for them. And I would peek out, you know, they're eating, I made lasagna, everybody's looking at them, and I was like, oh, they're eating it, they're so good. Okay. So, I got into the spell of cooking and also caring for other people, you know. It wasn't a choice. It was like, there's a part of myself, a part of yourself, which is this radiant, loving, compassionate being. But it was locked up under all these layers, you know. When I was practicing Zen, I wanted to be a great Zen master, you know. And that would mean I would finally be worthy of respect, people would love me, et cetera, you know. And so when I was sitting, you know, I was trying to be that Zen master, that great enlightened being. I would go into Genki Roshi and say, all is one, you know. And Genki, Genki was such a good man, you know, he would just say, well, keep sitting, you know, keep trying, you know. Then I had this detour, this waste of time, a waste of my precious time when I could be pursuing enlightenment and Zen master status, you know. And I have to cook for these fools, you know. Right? And you don't put it that way to yourself, but you're kind of thinking, yeah, on some level that's going on, right? And then honestly, I actually just got into it. It was like a spell. You know, I was just cooking. I would get up and go cook. And then I thought, oh, this will be delicious. They'll love this, you know. And a little bit, I mean, I see now in retrospect that I was enjoying taking care of other people, you know. And I hadn't had to do that in my entire life, right? I had never had to be caregiver for other people. And anyway, I got into this just totally. And at the end of the session, the food was just fantastic. I was so happy with the food. It was this idea that I have given people so much pleasure. And I had never in my life done that. I had never had that experience. You know, my own family had been a very unhappy place. And I had never, my mother had taken care of me, but I had never taken care of my mother. You know, I had never taken care of anybody, even my dog. You know, my mother took care of my dog, you know. So this was like the first time in my life I had taken care of other people, and it felt wonderful, wonderful. So anyway, at the end of the session, rather unexpectedly, somebody came into the kitchen and said, Genki Roshi wants to see you in Dokusan. So I went into Dokusan, and Genki Roshi said, this is the first time I have ever seen you act in a way that wasn't selfish. And he wasn't trying to hurt my feelings. He was just telling me the truth. And he said, you have passed the breath perception koan. And he said, and he gave me a new koan, the mu koan. And I wasn't, when he said, this is the first time I've seen you act in a way that wasn't self-centered, I think is what he said. I wasn't mad. It was like, okay, true, you know. And so this was like a moment of liberation, right? I encountered this part of myself, which is very much a loving kindness, you know, and a care for others. In Zen, we have a word for this. It's called bodhicitta, bodhicitta. When that arises, when that is released or activated, it's a life-transforming event. It's like first taste of enlightenment, you know. And it didn't come the way I thought. You know, what I thought would happen is that, you know, I would sit on the cushion, I would be a super good sitter, I would go into the Roshi and go, my God, you know. You're the reincarnation of so-and-so, you know. What incredible insight you have, you know. But I actually got it making béarnaise sauce, on tofu béarnaise, you know. And it wasn't in my intention, you know, but it came out. It's like inside all of us, underneath all these layers of fear and confusion, there's this radiant goodness inside each of us. And, you know, I have to say that after this experience, that goodness sort of receded again, you know. It opened up, and then, you know, a lot of my old habits came back, you know. You know, I was driving home, and I fell asleep in the car, and then I got out, and then a couple days later, I thought, you know, he didn't really pass me on the breath perception koan. You know, it wasn't a real pass. You know, and then I began to worry about the fact that I hadn't had a real pass. He kind of let me through, you know. So now I was back in my old neurotic self again. You know, did I really pass? Does he really think I'm any good? You know, will I ever be, blah, blah, blah? You know, so back. But in Zen practice, you know, there's this, you know, we work down through the layers of the mind, and we encounter our obstacles, and sometimes they seem so hard to get through. They seem so damn hard to get through. But you know, when we do get through them, there's this outpouring, this of radiant love, you know, and it's like an opening up, and then we close up a little bit. But then, you know, you keep practicing, and there's another opening, and then you close up a little bit, and there's another opening, and on and on, you know. But every time you open up and you get in touch with that elemental Buddha inside yourself, you know, it's changing you. You know, you develop more trust, you develop more care for others, your life becomes a bigger life, you know. Even when we try to help others, very often we're still driven by our compulsions, our neuroses, our fears and self-doubts, our insecurities, our envy, etc., etc. Even when we're trying to help others, there's often like a big ego in there somewhere. But every once in a while we break through some of our obstacles, and this radiance comes out. And this is the rhythm of Zen practice, you know. It's being small, being trapped in our smallness, being trapped in our fears, being trapped in our self-doubt or whatever, you know, having these dreams of greatness or glory or something, you know, and having them all fall to pieces, and then thinking, well, that's it, now I've got nothing, and then suddenly out comes this beautiful thing, which is inside of us. So, this is a story about a crazy monk named Lu Zhu. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. So, every time Lu Zhu encounters something challenging, he sits down and faces the wall. Sorry, something. I think I'm having allergies today. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. So, this is a little crazy story. Anytime I see a monk, I run back and sit down on my cushion and face the wall. Now, that's like crazy behavior, but it's kind of Zen, right? It's like every time we encounter an obstacle, we get back down on the cushion and we get to that still place and we begin to work through our obstacles. See, so this is a little bit like a joke. Nansen, hearing of this, said, I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty eon, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Lu Zhu, that way, will go on till the year of the ass. So, in a way, Nansen, Master Nansen, is complimenting Lu Zhu. He's saying, that's the way to go, boy. When you get stuck, you sit back down on the cushion and you face the wall of breath, the wall of mu. You still your mind and you begin the hard work of working through your obstacles. And sometimes we get down in the dumps and we think, well, I'll never be able to do it. You know, I can't do this. You know, getting mad, self-loathing, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, as I said to that woman, my colleague, you know, each of us is responsible for our own unhappiness. That doesn't mean we produced the situation that caused us to be unhappy, but there's no other way to get out of our unhappiness than to make the effort, you know. Nobody can liberate us but ourselves. If we need a situation like Sesshin to do it. We need a cooperating causes, as they're called in the Buddhist scriptures. We need an environment that's appropriate, and so on and so on. But finally, we have to work out our salvation ourselves. And so, Lu Zhu is doing the right thing. You know, he sits down when something throws him, when something knocked him off balance, when something causes him to become confused, he grounds himself in Mu, and he begins the hard work of working through his obstacles. And there may be obstacles without end, but every time we break through a little bit into that radiant compassion, it's like nothing else in the world. It's really well worth it. And the world becomes a bigger place and more fully our home. Verse, in plainness there's flavor, subtlety transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. On bending, like an idiot, his path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. Inside of ourselves, there's the pearl, that radiance. And Zen practice is a way of liberating that radiance, you know. And actually, the pearl is helping us. You know, there is a Buddha mind inside each of us. And it's working, we're working from this side, and Buddha mind is working from the other side. And we're going to meet in the middle sometimes, and when we do, it's going to be wonderful. So all the time that our conscious mind is trying to liberate us, at the core of our unconscious, there's an intelligence which is vast, and really endless, infinite, and boundlessly compassionate, and it's trying to help us too. So we have a great ally inside of ourselves that we just have to trust. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters.